Welcome to Leonard Legal Buzz, produced by the law firm of Leonard, Street & Dinard. There is a fundamental divide between scientists and lawyers. The divide can be wide and deep, and it strongly impacts how practitioners in these disciplines think, communicate, and work together. To succeed in sci-tech litigation, where the issues at stake hinge on science and technology, you need a team that can cross this divide, a team that can work together effectively and explain your case in court persuasively and in ordinary language the judge and jury will understand. Joining me to discuss the issues to consider in sci-tech litigation are Jim Bullard and Dan Colton. Jim is chair of Leonard Street & Dinard's Business and Commercial Litigation Department and has been named among the best lawyers in America in the area of commercial litigation. Dan has a master's degree in geochemistry and mineral exploration and worked with an international consulting firm before changing career paths and going to law school. Together, Jim and Dan have litigated more than two decades worth of science and technology matters. The duo heads Leonard Street & Dinard's sci-tech litigation practice. Their tips for successful sci-tech litigation have been published in Minnesota Lawyer. Welcome, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks.
Now, Jim, the term sci-tech litigation may be new to some of our listeners. Would you define what sci-tech litigation is and when it comes up?
Sci-tech litigation is a term that Dan and I coined, and we coined it to describe something we were seeing in our own cases in the real world. And what we mean by that is science-heavy cases. That's a category of lawsuits in which the issues turn on science and technology. It used to be that you'd see those issues in patent cases or environmental cases. Today, we see them in all kinds of cases. And so what we're trying to get at is that there's another level of complexity in these cases. And it might be a contract case. It might be an employment case. It could be any kind of case. But if you need to truly understand a difficult science or engineering question in order to understand the facts of your case, you've now got a sci-tech case. And as I said, in our experience, sci-tech cases are becoming more common, and it sure helps to know what you're facing at the outset of one of those cases.
And Dan, why are these kinds of cases particularly challenging for businesses?
Sci-tech cases are challenging because, in addition to all the kinds of problems any lawsuit presents, a sci-tech case layers on additional questions of science and technology. And to answer those questions of sci-technology requires the attorney to locate, retain, and work with experts. And for that attorney to master that case in a way where they can present a creative, insightful, and compelling case to their client, the jury, a judge, the lawyer needs to understand the sci-tech facts, have a comfort level intellectually with science and technology and the laws that control it, and then also that lawyer needs to be able to think on his or her feet throughout the case. The other reason sci-tech is challenging is it sits at the intersection of science and the legal process. You have professionals, lawyers, experts, doctors, scientists, engineers from very different backgrounds with divergent intellectual traditions. So all these folks come to the table with different methods of reasoning, different approaches to problem solving, a different vocabulary and style of communication, which the lawyer needs to deal with.
And Dan, from our client's perspective, I think it's fair to say that we find that sci-tech cases are on the top of their radar screen because they typically involve a critical product or a fundamental aspect of some way this company is running its business. And so these cases are crucial to their survival.
I'd agree. Good point.
Now, in the introduction, and Dan alluded to it a few moments ago, I mentioned a fundamental divide between scientists and lawyers. What does that mean exactly?
If I can use an analogy, the divide is the split that occurs when you come to a fork in a road and you follow a different path for a long period of time. And that's what we have here. Following one fork in the road are the students in high school who concentrated on science and math, and they've pursued that path through college, graduate school, and now work experiences. On the other side of the fork are the students who pursued liberal arts classes and became lawyers and had very different experiences along the way. You know, part of this is inherent. It's a self-selection process. Nobody makes anybody follow the path that they follow in life. But at the end of these divergent educational paths and job experiences, you have professionals who don't communicate very well anymore. Most lawyers don't understand the language of science. They don't understand the problem-solving methods of science. On the other hand, because of their specialization, the scientists and the engineers don't speak ordinary language anymore. When they talk in their field, they use equations, they use a specialized vocabulary, and they're very uncomfortable trying to abandon that and speak in ordinary language. In addition, We found in our experience that technically trained professionals are very uncomfortable given the fluid nature of litigation, where I think they would say the ground moves under my feet. You keep changing the facts on me. And that's because we're in the process of discovering the facts, and we have an adversary who's undermining those facts. So it's true, it's a very fluid situation, which makes them very uncomfortable. Anyway, the gist of all of that is that you've got an intellectual and communication divide that you have to cross so you can work together as a team to solve the client's problems.
Now, Dan, you have a background in science and have moved from that world into the law. How did you bridge that gap exactly?
Good question. As you indicated in the introduction, I've got a master's degree in geochemistry thermodynamics. That entails graduate level calculus, chemistry, and statistics. After graduate school, I applied my science background for about 4 years, working with a large international consulting engineering firm. During that time, I worked with other scientists, engineers, in solving client problems. These clients range from Department of Energy, working on their nuclear weapons production industrial complex facilities, to working with private companies, mining and manufacturing, and addressing their various environmental contamination issues. During that time, I worked with a lot of attorneys as well, as we were working with these clients to resolve substantial liability issues they have. And it's at that point in time, after about 4 years, that I decided I'd go to law school. And the reason was, while working with our clients, I observed the divide. And I, at that time, was on the science side of the divide. I saw how clients were ill-served with or by the divide and the frustration levels that could grow when you had two intelligent professions unable to communicate with one another.
And Jim, with you, with having a background in the law and then now working so much in science and technology issues, why don't you talk about how you've bridged the gap in the opposite direction?
Let me begin by noting that it's a challenge in each and every case to cross that divide. Divide's a little bit different in each case, and it's a challenge each and every time. I do stand on the law side of that divide, and that's because of my background. I'm a history major in college. I read novels and poetry for recreation. I'm on that side of the divide. The scientists are on the other side of the divide because of their backgrounds. What I think helps in this challenging process to get across the divide is knowing you can do it and liking the people and liking the subjects on the other side of the divide. And I think that's true of me. I grew up in a town called Livermore, California, which is home of the Lawrence Radiation Laboratory, a national lab that employs thousands of people in a small town. My dad worked there. Most of my classmates in high school had parents who worked there. We all thought we were going to grow up and be scientists. That's how I started off in college. And I changed my mind after organic chemistry. That's a natural result for someone with my set of talents. But the point is, I like science. I'm interested in science. I have friends who are scientists. I respect the work that scientists do, and I'm not afraid to ask questions. And I understand that with goodwill, I should be able to translate what they're trying to communicate into language that ordinary people can understand. And when I get to that point, I know I've crossed the divide.
Dan, what elements influence the success of SciTech cases?
The success of a SciTech case, of course, in our view, depends upon your ability to bridge the divide. Over the course of 20 years, Jim and I have identified elements or building blocks that we think are used to successfully bridge that divide. The first is lawyers. You need good lawyers. The second would be experts. The third is strategy. The fourth is teamwork and communications. And the fifth is presentation of your case. At the end of the day, it's the lawyer who is responsible for building the bridge, making sure that bridge works, with what we believe are those, the four elements: experts, strategy, teamwork, and presentation. It's the lawyer that has to find the experts and then work with them to get the product you need to win the case. It's the lawyer who has to, with the experts, develop the strategy. The earlier, the better. Keep updating that strategy as the facts in your matter, the SciTech facts, change. You need a strategy that's responsive to the dynamics of your case as it changes through discovery. And it's the lawyer who makes sure that they build an effective team that works together and communicates. This requires an effective division of labor, good team chemistry, and making sure that all the players, all the members on the team, understand the client's objectives. And finally, it's the lawyer that will need to present this case in a clear, credible, creative, focused, and comprehensive message. And given that this is SciTech, you're going to be relying on graphics. And as Jim and I like to say, they've got to be Nova-like. They've got to be visually captivating, simple, and self-explanatory to the layman. Now, the sooner you as a lawyer pull all those elements together, the experts, the strategy, the teamwork, and the good communication, the better. For example, the earlier you get experts on board and involved with your team, the sooner they can be available to process the facts, the information, and work with you in understanding the SciTech issues, even to the point of developing programs to procure SciTech facts. And the sooner you can develop a strategy then, knowing your facts, that incorporates all the information, the sooner you have a team that is sailing and not drifting.
You know, I'd like to try an analogy to wrap up this point. And the analogy I'd like to use is that of writing a novel. So we're in a SciTech case, but it's not just about science and technology. And if you ask the experts on one side of the divide to write that novel, I can guarantee that the science and engineering facts would be accurate. They would be covered in excruciating detail. The novel would be 2,000 pages long, and I don't think it would be a bestseller. Now, with our help on the other side of that divide, we're going to cut that novel down to 300 or 400 pages, some readable length. And while we're going to identify and cover the important science and engineering facts, we're not going to forget the human dynamics and the human elements. So you end up with a book, a novel, that people are actually read and understand. So the product, in the end, requires contributions from both sides of the divide.
Clearly, relying on experts is a fundamental factor in the success or lack of success of SciTech litigation cases. How do you find the right experts?
Well, like all professions, like doctors themselves know that there are good doctors and there are not so good doctors. Same in the legal profession. The same can be said for in the engineering as well as science. And over the years, Jim and I have learned, and I think Jim would agree with me, that it's an art. It's sort of a sixth sense we've developed over the 20 or more years of practice. But there is an approach. First and foremost, you have to know your facts. And that requires spending time with your client, and over a short period of time, becoming conversant in what your SciTech issues are. At that point, you might then start identifying the type of expertise you may need for your case. Now, I'd bet that more often than not, most attorneys wouldn't know that there's a significant difference between a scientist and an engineer. There is, and it can be significant. And it can be so significant, it may affect the outcome of your case. Therefore, you need to know whether you need a scientist, an engineer, or more than one or two of them on your case. In addition, you need to know what discipline are you working with. As a hydrologist will tell you, they're not all alike. Some are field-oriented, others are mathematical-oriented or modelers. Same with chemists. You may have organic chemists, inorganic chemists. You might have applied or theoretical chemists. So the second step is identifying the expertise you need and focusing in on the various fields that need to be addressed. At that point, where do you find these experts? That's where, again, with our experience, Jim and I can rely on our networks that we've developed over the 20 or more years of practice. I've kept my networks with the scientists, engineers that I've worked with over the past 20 years open and growing. You also contact your client. Your client oftentimes will have in-house engineers who know their business better than you will ever know their business. And they also know experts in the field who know their business. That can be a very, very productive source. And then once you bring experts on, in addition, experts themselves can help you find other experts they've worked with in the past, not necessarily in the litigation context, but in their own profession. Once you have your list of experts, you now need to screen those experts to make sure that they will work to your favor.
Why don't you talk about the kind of screening process that you use specifically when you're choosing experts?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. When we have our list of experts on paper, we will call them in because aside from their paper record, things like their reputation, their publications, and their credentials, Jim and I are very interested in knowing and getting a read on their personality and character. And why do we think that's important? Because the way we operate, Jim and I operate, is there is always a dynamic tension between the lawyers Jim and I generally, and our experts. And what that means is we use a very aggressive internal peer review of all work these experts produce. Rarely do we stand on an expert's first report. There's a lot of internal debate and dialogue that goes on between the lawyers and the experts before we produce a product, which ends up being what? Their opinion with supplementary expert report. So when we're interviewing, we're looking for experts who work well within that dynamic tension. And so we're looking for team players. We're looking for experts who are willing to cross the divide. They need to be able to come over and try to come over to our side of the fence as much as we're willing to go to their side of the divide. They have to be credible. They have to have a presence. And again, their character. They've got to be able to hold up under that dynamic tension. And it's not fun. Some of our biggest battles are in-house with our experts. But what we find is that internal, that dynamic tension, the internal peer review, really sets them up well for depositions and cross-exam during trial.
This dynamic tension that Dan is talking about is extremely important because the lawyers are in charge of the case. They're the captain of the ship. And the lawyers know what they want to present in court. They've got to get it right. They need the experts, but they have to tug and pull to get the experts where they need to go. And that's what we're calling dynamic tension. It's an internal fighting match sometimes to get where you need to go.
Yeah, I think one thing experts don't realize is the reason we're in litigation is the facts are in play. We're fighting over the facts, and these are scientific and technological facts. And so oftentimes you'll sit down with an expert and say, okay, this is your opinion based on this fact set. Well, how about if I change that fact set? How about if we add a few facts? Or how about if I take a few facts away? How does your opinion change? And so at the end of the day, after you've been pushing and prodding that expert, trying to find out how his opinion changes as a function of a changing fact set, they feel used, abused, a bit manipulated, thinking, oh, this is classic legal system. But again, I think what they learn is that this is exactly what they're going to be exposed to in deposition and on cross-exam. And it's going to be a battle of what is the fact set at the end of the day that prevails and the opinions that are reasonable based on that fact set.
Now, obviously, this can be a complicated process. Where can things go wrong?
Because it is complicated, the fact is it can go wrong anywhere, at any time, in any part of the process. That goes with the territory, and you need to expect that. I think rather than focusing on where it can go wrong, the focus should be on how do you minimize the problems when they do occur. And I'd suggest three things are key. One is experienced counsel that have done this before. Second is the right experts. And third is good teamwork. Now, we've talked at some length about the role of the lawyers and the experts. I want to focus on teamwork because that's absolutely vital. In our experience, real-world experience, no SciTech case is a solo endeavor. It's a team effort. You need the teamwork for effective communication. You need the teamwork for good chemistry. You need the teamwork to help spot and head off problems before they arise. Now, here's what I mean by teamwork. I mean the lawyers and the experts spending enough time together and being comfortable with each other that the experts really understand what the lawyers are trying to accomplish. And the lawyers really understand what the experts are telling them. So it's real face time together, talking about this case in ways that both sides understand the other's perspective, and you're well on your way to crossing the divide. And that's the key to minimizing problems and then solving problems when they come up.
Now, I understand that from time to time, you have to deal with what is called junk science. What constitutes junk science, and how do you deal with it?
In the civil litigation context, junk science rears its ugly head in the expert opinions and reports themselves that rely on half-truths, inappropriate assumptions, and other distortions of the laws of science and technology. Examples of junk science may be things like the selective use of data and facts, misleading graphical presentations, skewing calculations by manipulating input assumptions, or misrepresenting or distorting factual significances. For example, the range of uncertainties associated with the facts at issue. Now, when you identify junk science, you need to, as lawyers, dismantle it or unmask it. And we believe that the key to unmasking or dismantling junk science is coordination between the attorneys and your experts. And by coordination, what do we mean? We mean early on, you make your experts aware that we may be seeing junk science. Keep your eyes out for it. And when you see it, let us know. At that point, we convene and talk about the junk science and its significance, large or small, to the case. The sooner you're able to identify junk science, the better, because it gives you the time necessary to develop and implement a strategy. Strategies are going to vary based upon the type of junk science you're confronted with, of course. But generally, as I said, you sit down, you storybook, you figure out what is it that the opposing side's doing and what is the junk science and why are they throwing it at you, and you develop a program to counter it. One way we've handled junk science in the past is we've actually developed investigations, either in the field or in the laboratory, to develop evidences to directly rebut the junk science, that is, make it moot.
And let me just note that junk science is a litigation opportunity that Dan and I look for, because if you can find junk science and unmask it, you not only destroy that particular expert report or opinion, but you've exposed a major credibility issue. Why would you ever bother to listen again to the expert who offered up junk science?
In the end, what are some practical tips that businesses should consider when they find themselves involved in sci-tech litigation to most effectively bridge the science-law divide?
You know, to answer that question, I think you need to keep in mind the point that a sci-tech case is bigger and more complex than an ordinary case. You need to be prepared for that. You've got a bigger obstacle. You've got a bigger hill to climb. And if I can use the analogy of a journey or a trip, you're taking a journey that's going to be off the road, off the beaten path, and it's going to have some pretty big hills to climb. You're certainly going to encounter some unfamiliar territory, and you need to be prepared for that. Now, what I think this means in practical terms is four things. First, experience counts for a lot. Experience in working with experts, experience in handling big cases, and particularly experience in bridging the science-law divide. Second, you need to be able to move fast and early, even at the outset of the case. This isn't just a journey, it's a race. And the earlier you get to the right experts, begin to fill in the big picture so you can pursue your own focused discovery and develop a strategy, the better off you're going to be in the race with the opposing party. Third, you need to build a team. This is not a solo effort. And fourth, while the science and technology issues may be central to the case, they're not the whole case. And you need to understand and explain the human and business issues that underlie that science and technology. There's a dispute here, and the key to persuading the judge and the jury may be the human relationships underneath that dispute, and maybe some common sense factor, and if you can find it and prove it, dismantling credibility through junk science, or perhaps showing that the other side is lying, cheating, or stealing. None of that's science, but it can win your case.
But it may take science to understand that they're lying, cheating, and stealing.
That's exactly right, Dan, and we can't just say those things. We have to prove them.
That's right.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, Jim. And Dan, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us. If you'd like to learn more, we invite you to contact us at 612-335-1500 or visit us online at www.leonard.com. Leonard Street & Dinard is among Minnesota's largest law firms, with offices in Minneapolis, St. Cloud, and Mankato, Minnesota, and in Washington, D.C. From its regional base, Leonard Street & Dinard serves clients throughout the United States and internationally. The firm employs nearly 200 attorneys in more than 40 practice areas, and since its founding in 1922, has helped generations of clients achieve their business objectives through astute legal advice, complemented by good common sense. To learn more, visit Leonard Street & Dinard's website at www.leonard.com. This podcast is provided by the law firm of Leonard Street & Dinard as a service to clients and the general public. The information contained in this recording is neither designed nor intended to be relied upon as specific legal advice to any individual or organization. Listeners should always consult with their attorney about specific legal matters.